Hi, and welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. As always, we welcome suggestions for future topics and guests, but today I'm joined by Dr. Mark Downing, who is an infectious disease specialist at Nova Scotia Health and currently a student in the University of Toronto Joint Centre for Bioethics Master's Program. Our discussion today is going to explore how policies designed to address the need for infection prevention and control within healthcare facilities can sometimes affect access to care. So maybe to start us off, Mark, you can briefly give some examples of the ways that tensions can arise between those two important objectives.
Thank you, Marika. It's a pleasure to be here. So to start with, it's best to look at what is the goal of infection prevention and control. And really, it's fundamentally to prevent transmission of organisms in the healthcare setting, whether it's hospitals. You can think about long-term care, for instance. And so how do we achieve that goal? And really, the fundamental and most primitive but most effective way we have of achieving that goal is isolating, and that is primarily looking at patients. And so to think about where the tensions can rise when we talk about access, we can look at the patient level, we can look more macro at the unit level, and then we can look at the organizational level. So starting off at the patient level, when someone comes into hospital where we're worried they might have something that could be transmitted to others, we put them in isolation precautions, and there's a whole bucket of things that come with that. But the primary goal is to put them in a private room, and usually those coming into the room would wear additional personal protective equipment or PPE. And so that is effective at achieving our goal of preventing transmission, but it comes with some consequences. And there is some literature prior to the pandemic which suggests that care is impacted as a result, because it's an increased workload to care for someone in precautions. So a healthcare worker might have to put on additional PPE, don it, and then doff it again when they come out. And so we know that that likely leads to less frequent assessments of patients, and as a result, impairs their access to care. So that's something we knew before the pandemic. You can look at a unit level. So when we declare an outbreak, it's usually in the unit setting. One of the things to consider when looking at how that might impact access to care is when we close the unit to admissions. And so sometimes we would do that in, say, an influenza outbreak prior to the pandemic. That means that patients can't be admitted to that floor because we're trying to protect them from getting whatever pathogen is associated with the outbreak. That can have implications, though, as you get more and more outbreaks, as we were seeing during the pandemic. So if you have widespread outbreaks throughout a hospital, you can't afford to close all the units because patients coming into hospital have to go somewhere, and that can have an impact on their care. Going out the other side, too, of an outbreak, often facilities will limit admissions from outbreak units. And so if someone, for example, is waiting for rehab, and they're in an outbreak, they may have their discharge delayed as a result. So that's an access to care issue. And then on an institutional level, and this popped up more and more during the pandemic, we can think about policies that impact care broadly and access to care. One example is virtual care. So we heavily emphasized virtual care early in the pandemic as a way of preventing people from coming in and out of the hospital. Both to protect those patients where we were delivering the virtual care, but also everyone else who may have been exposed to something that they were bringing in. And certainly there are probably examples where that limited their access to the care they needed in person. So that's one consideration. And then another example is visitor restrictions. And so if we think about what happened in 2020 with an emerging pathogen, we felt the need to restrict visitation, again, because we knew that COVID-19 was circulating broadly in the community and people coming in from the community might bring it with them. And over time, we realized that there were harms associated with that that were probably underestimated initially. And we can talk a little bit about that further later on.
Yeah, I think those provide a really nice example of the ways where we really need to balance competing but similarly weighty or similarly important values when we create health policy and when we're designing healthcare systems. So thinking about some of the obligations that we have in healthcare environments to protect people, you know, from infection. So recognizing that generally it's sick people who are coming to, you know, to access healthcare, and that we don't want to make them sicker for having, you know, entered the facility or entered the care environment. But also, again, recognizing that that trying to do that to prevent the infection really does have, you know, costs in a number of ways. And, you know, we tended to perhaps downplay or didn't realize the extent of sort of early on in the pandemic response when we were really focusing on limiting exposure. And I think maybe just for you as a person working in healthcare, if you could say a bit about sort of the difference between healthcare environments and the way we approach infection prevention and control in those environments versus others where you have a lot of people together in closed spaces. So things like, you know, schools or university or other, you know, settings, some, you know, carceral settings where you've got a lot of folks together. So are there some different obligations or different ways that we weigh those values when we're looking at it in the healthcare context?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And fundamentally, it might have to do with who's vulnerable in that setting. And so healthcare, in a way, is sort of the last frontier of where we've maintained precautions during the pandemic, because we know this is where the most vulnerable populations are, in particular, thinking about immunocompromised patients. And we do have an obligation to protect them. And so you will continue to see things like universal masking, vaccine mandates, things like that, in efforts to protect that vulnerable population. I think as an organization, if you're a healthcare institution, you also have the ability to implement things that may not be as easy to introduce in the public space. So thinking about sort of general public areas, but also school systems and other organizations, it may be more challenging to do that, especially if you think about schools and in a child population. You have to consider, you know, what precautions can a child actually follow and what's reasonable. And how does that impact their social development as a result? And some of those questions do come up too in more chronic settings. You look at long-term care specifically. This was a space where we implemented visitor restrictions for quite a long period of time. And they were one of our most vulnerable populations during the pandemic. And that obviously had dramatic impacts. You look at the commission that was done in Ontario on that, for instance. And so I don't think it's necessarily dissimilar from other settings, but the primary consideration is that vulnerable population that we care for.
Right. So it does have that shift in the way that we weigh the same considerations, but the context matters. And I think also, you know, identifying sort of what's feasible, you know, given the population as well, mm-hmm. that I think that's also something where there was a lot of learning over the course of the pandemic around what's sort of feasible, particularly for family members or members of the community coming in, and also what is, you know, sustainable over time as well, and that those started to play a role in some of the considerations around how we're balancing and weighing the different values. So I'm curious for you, as someone who's been working in infection prevention and control, if your thinking has changed about some of those policies over the course of your experiences with COVID, again, particularly as it relates to access to care, and again, the way that you saw some of those subtle effects of those policies on the ability of patients to access care they needed.
So I think it's a great question, and there's a couple of things to consider here. One is resource allocation during the pandemic. So prior to the pandemic, certainly we've lived in a healthcare system that had limited resources, and that would be a consideration in the background throughout a number of our policies. But during the pandemic, increasingly, that became the primary issue. And so trying to decide where resources were best allocated became more and more of a decision point. And that's ultimately what motivated me to pursue more education in bioethics, because as a scientific expert, I thought the most challenging questions I was getting were ethical ones. And so I think that thinking has carried forward, and we see that in the micro and macro sort of areas of the hospital as well. So I think on any given day, you may have one airborne isolation room, which is a special type of room we might use for patients with airborne infections. If we only have one available, but three patients that come in needing that room, we have to go through a resource allocation exercise to decide how best to allocate that room and how to mitigate the risks to the other patients and healthcare workers in the facility. So I think that's something that we've all hopefully gotten better at. Another element I think to consider is not only, you know, the outcome of the decisions, but the process itself. And so thinking about procedural justice when it comes to decision-making during the pandemic. And most healthcare facilities stood up an incident management system or something similar to that. And that has pros and cons. Certainly in an acute crisis, that's something you would use. But as we know, the pandemic became sort of subacute and then chronic. And as a result, how does that decision-making change over time? And so initially, you look at how decisions were made. It would be by a small group of leaders within an organization. And it would be sort of referred to as a deliberative democracy, where they're trying to make decisions based on what reasonable people would do. But over time, I think it became obvious that there are always going to be gaps in what people know when they're not using a more fulsome participatory sort of democracy. And I think that's what we learned. And I don't know the right way to incorporate that up front in the decision-making process when there's a crisis, but something to consider too in terms of different points of view. And then finally, we can think about social justice. And getting back to the long-term care example, that was one that stuck with me, where you have a very vulnerable group in long-term care residents. We wouldn't normally use the term oppression, but I think you can think of elements that are associated with that. And then policies that come in that likely worsen that oppression, in particular visitor restriction. And so going ahead, thinking about how social justice may have improved that situation from the get-go. And again, that's more a question for me than a possible answer, but something to consider as well too.
But I think it demonstrates that our thinking shifted as our experience with responding to pandemic went on, and as it became clear that it wasn't going to be an acute event, that it was going to be more chronic. And so I think there, again, when we're thinking about how we weigh different values, that initially it was a very strong emphasis on infection prevention particularly, and then, as shifting on to think about, but what does that mean in terms of access to care, sort of who can't get in the door? And thinking too about, again, the different sorts of roles that, sort of community members or that loved ones play in care. I think there's an interesting distinction that became clear between, the sort of what might be called essential care partners, who are loved ones coming in, and some of the work really that they were doing and that the healthcare system was counting on them to do, as opposed to the sort of more social visitation. But I think both of those certainly affected access to care for patients going through the system. And certainly speaking for myself, I think that prior to the pandemic, when I thought about access to care, it was really about sort of getting to the building, getting to the service you need, getting to the specialist that you'd been referred to, or even getting an appointment with your primary care provider. But that sort of, that piece of even sort of getting into the building and getting close sort of wasn't on the radar. And so I'm wondering if you found amongst your colleagues who are not involved directly in infection prevention and control, if they've had a sort of similar shift in terms of how they're thinking about access to care.
Well, I would certainly say, and I'd lead with the disclaimer that, I trained in Nova Scotia and I've been away in Ontario for 15 years, and I'm coming back as of this year. And one thing I notice in particular is how much virtual care happens here as a result of it being primarily a rural province. And that is a good thing, probably more than not, I would say. And the pandemic may have accelerated that, I suspect. So it might have been a silver lining in a way in terms of understanding how do we best use virtual care. I'm sure there were bumps along the road and there will continue to be, but in general, I think there's some times where virtual care actually enhances access, right? But yes, I think certainly, and everyone is done with the pandemic at a different rate, and you see that in your colleagues too. So I think some have had a hard time letting go of those initial precautions that they were taking and going back to in-person care, even though that probably would have been the right thing to do in some circumstances. Whereas others, I think, were much more eager to get back to that, you know, need for an in-person visit with someone just as part of human nature. So I think it's been quite variable and interesting. And the right balance is sort of to be determined, I would say. We're still sort of living in a world where we're getting waves of COVID and trying to understand what the right amount of access is in person.
And I think, yeah, it shows that, you know, that it's not just a... an impediment to access to care, to to be attentive to strategies necessary for infection prevention and control, that there can be, like you say, some silver linings or ways that we find to provide care in ways that actually increase access potentially for some communities. For myself, going and being involved in the ethics conversations, visiting policies in particular have been highlighted by a lot of folks that I chat with, so including patients, loved ones, and healthcare providers, as causing a lot of moral distress during the pandemic. So from your conversations or your experience, what do you see as sort of the reasons for that moral distress that was being experienced in response to the visitation policies?
Maybe I'll lead with a personal story. So we had a child during the pandemic, and for most of the prenatal visits, I wasn't allowed to come. And, you know, we would sort of joke about it, but I think in hindsight, it was a significant barrier to my wife getting prenatal care and me being there to support her. So I do have a personal view on it that I can hopefully relate to when it comes to patients and families. I think it has shifted, and there's more and more evidence in the literature from the pandemic demonstrating the harms associated with visitation restriction. On the flip side, though, and I think this is what one of the more interesting and challenging things to think about is, it seems clear to me that more and more we acknowledge that patients have a right to visitation, but we have to remember that we live in facilities or work in facilities where patients don't have private rooms for the most part, at least in Nova Scotia. And so respecting one patient's autonomy and allowing them to have a visitor in also has an impact on their roommate in particular. And that roommate may not have the same choice in whether a visitor in the next bed over is exposing them to a communicable disease. And so these are the really challenging questions, I think, is how do we weigh those competing priorities between roommates? And I think it has to be done. And, you know, case by case, I think, is a term that's probably overused during the pandemic because it's sort of an easy way to get out of a ethical dilemma. But they really do have to be case by case. And I think maybe this is also when, and you know, we talk about an ethic of care, that might be a better model to use rather than an ethic of justice, where you are looking at someone's individual context and trying to understand what is the right scenario or solution based on who's in the room, who the roommate is, and then going from there.
And I think that case-by-case piece was also something that folks really struggled with, in that different people had different interpretations given the same case, or they felt, you know, that it was more than they sort of had the bandwidth or capacity to do to sort of sort out what was fair in this case with this family. And is it the same as that family last week who will probably talk to, you know, the first family in the community sort of thing? So I think there were sort of a lot of layers to that experience, not just in Nova Scotia, but I think, you know, particularly in smaller communities where information travels, you know, very effectively at Sobeys sort of thing about, you know, what's happened to whom in healthcare settings. And so I think that that was something that played a significant role in the moral distress that individuals were experiencing around, you know, trying to negotiate that case by case, even as, you know, on the policy side, you recognize that there really does need to be the opportunity to respond to the situation and to respond differently, for example, to an end-of-life situation as opposed to maybe, you know, a shorter stay, you know, for surgery or something along those lines. And that it's very difficult to, you know, policy tends to be a blunt instrument. And yet, you know, folks really were hungry for that guidance so that they didn't feel that they were bearing the weight of, you know, being the person who says, you know, yes or no, you can see your parent, you know, who is at the end of their life or not, sort of thing. And as, you know, as your personal example indicates, you know, it was really meaningful things for people that that were affected by these policies. So I feel like there's lots more we could explore, and certainly I anticipate that listeners have experiences of their own that this conversation has probably brought up. So I'm hoping that, you know, folks do take some of these themes back and have some of those further conversations. But as we're trying to sort of wrap it up, I'm wondering if you can provide sort of a quick summary from your perspective of why it's often so complicated to manage those needs related to infection prevention and control while also, you know, ensuring or enhancing access to care.
Yeah, I think to summarize, really, infection prevention and control is in the business of preventing transmission. And one of the most effective ways of doing that is to prevent interactions between people, which on the flip side is part of human nature. And so that balance, I think, became much more obvious as the pandemic went on. And trying to be reasonable is really the challenge, and needing to be able to pivot and be fluid based on what's happening. And so I think it'll continue to be a challenge. And hopefully we, as the pandemic dies down or fades away, it becomes less of an ethical concern in the forefront and maybe lingering in the background. But we shouldn't forget that these are always decisions that are that have an ethical lens to them as well.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that, that they're always there and that being aware of their presence is something that we can all take forward. So thank you so much, Mark, for sharing both your expertise and your thoughtful reflections that have been, you know, generated in the crucible of the pandemic. We so appreciate you taking the time and sharing the insight that you've generated.
Thank you, Marika. It was a pleasure to be here.
We're also grateful for the production support that we receive from Lisbeth Wittholf-Nielsen, Krista Melischko-Skerry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. Thank you, too, to Ben Capps for our theme music, and most of all, thank you for listening. Until next time. Thank you.